At first glance, the idea of blind people having gun permits seems to fly in the face of common sense, to be absurd. But it turns out it's not. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, my conversation with the sheriff of Cedar County. He's taught his visually impaired daughter to use firearms. Also, a talk with blind author Steve Cusisto about his thoughts on this Iowa story about weapons permits for the blind that's created quite a buzz in the media. Also, we'll talk with former astronaut Clayton Anderson, who's accepted a position at ISU, the annual running of the Cy-Hawk football from Iowa City to Ames ahead of the big game, and we ask, what's behind superstitions on this Friday the 13th? First, this news. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, Iowa's blind and their advocates have found themselves in the middle of an international buzz about a state law that allows visually impaired people to carry guns in public. It's a discussion that was sparked by a Des Moines Register article last Sunday. It was a report that told the story of three legally or completely blind Iowans who have been granted gun permits since January of 2011, and that's the date that Iowa became a so-called shall-issue state. Well, this story has created a whole lot of buzz outside of Iowa, a range of media outlets, NPR, Fox, ABC, CBS, also news outlets overseas, the BBC, Al Jazeera. Even The Onion did some satire on it. Well, one person with a unique perspective on the question of whether it's a good idea to have the visually impaired get guns and gun permits, just like anyone else, is Warren Wethington. He's the sheriff of Cedar County here in Iowa. He's taught his visually impaired daughter, Bethany, who's 18 now, to use firearms, and joins us now. Sheriff Wethington, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
On its face, it seems to fly in the face of common sense. It even seems absurd to a lot of people to have blind people carrying and shooting guns. Tell us why you think it's not.
Well, I think part of the hysteria is people don't know what it's like to be blind or visually impaired. I'll start by saying if somehow my glasses get knocked off, I'm visually impaired. I'm probably legally blind.
But as a sheriff, you would still, in a certain situation, might need to use your weapon.
Yeah. You know, in a dark night, I spent the first 15, 20 years of my career working nights. Well, at night, you're visually impaired. If you get into some kind of an altercation, wind up with blood or pepper mace in your eyes, you're visually impaired. The only thing different between myself and my daughter is she's had 18 years to get used to it, and I'm newly blinded. I've got 10 seconds to learn how to adapt with this.
So in a way, you can see it as an advantage in certain situations.
To some extent, you know, it's obviously it's a handicap, but discharging a firearm, it's all about ability and your own personal limitations. You know, some sighted people can't hit a paper plate at 10 yards. Now, my daughter, who's legally blind, she's 2350. She has no problem hitting a paper plate. You know, she has more ability than a sighted person.
So you started quite early teaching Bethany, who's 18, to use firearms. How impaired is her sight to begin with?
Her left eye, if you move your hand in front of it, she can tell that something's moving. She can't tell left, right, up and down, or that it's even a hand. In her right eye, she's 2350, which in Iowa, 2200 is legally blind.
When did you start teaching her to shoot?
Well, she's been around firearms all her life. I would guess probably around 6 years old, we started shooting BB guns, and she's just progressed up.
Mm-hmm. How is teaching, and I imagine in your position, you've taught a number of people to shoot firearms. How have you found it teaching Bethany different than teaching a fully sighted person?
Well, I've taught the permit class since the early 90s, and I'm a certified ILA firearms instructor. You know, you can't go into a room, set up a PowerPoint, and teach 20 students at once. You have to take one student one-on-one with the instructor, and a lot depending on the level of vision, but it's a lot more hands-on. You know, you have to use their hands and show them how to do things by touch and feel, where, you know, a sighted person, it's all visual.
Are there special concerns that a visually impaired person has to be aware of, they have to be more aware of, should there be a reason to use a weapon?
Well, I'm going to answer that. If you're in a room and the lights go totally out, it's complete darkness, you know, you're blind, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody were in there with you, would you be able to tell whether they were planning to do serious injury or cause you death in a totally dark room?
Only by, I guess, what I heard or what I felt.
There you go. Most people don't think it through that far. It's, they can't see, so they're helpless. Now, a blind person, if somebody comes up to you and throws you on the ground and starts to choke you out, a reasonable person in like circumstances, and that's state code, a reasonable person in like circumstances would believe that they're in danger of serious injury or death. That's the definition of what justifies deadly force.
Mm-hmm.
Now, being a reasonable person, if somebody starts choking you out, you would be able to understand that something bad's about to happen, correct?
Right.
Blind people aren't any different.
Well, I guess the concern would be maybe a different scenario. A concern that might leap to mind is that a blind person would be more likely to misidentify a threat and shoot it, say, on their property or in their house. Is that a concern?
Well, again, we're dealing with different levels of vision. You know, in my opinion, a totally blind person, you know, we're talking about visually impaired, not mentally impaired, they're going to know whether they're in serious in the threat of serious injury or death. If somebody gets them down, there's no reason why a totally blind person can't draw a weapon, rotate it up into the midsection of their assailant, and discharge a round. Now, would I say a totally blind person should be shooting at a sound? No, that's ridiculous to even think that somebody should do that. But, you know, like Bethany, she can make out a knife or a gun or a baseball bat at 10 or 15 yards.
Mm-hmm. In 2011, Iowa became a so-called shall-issue state. How did that change things for gun owners who were visually impaired?
Well, it changed things for every gun owner across the state. Prior to 2011, if you were in a county where the sheriff was anti-gun, you didn't get a permit. It was solely up to the sheriff and their political views. If you were in a county where the sheriff was pro-gun, you could get a permit. You know, now it's even playing field across the state. There's certain curriculum they have to meet, and if you don't meet that, you don't get a permit, or if you do, you will get a permit.
Do you think there are any situations, your daughter has partial sight, but perhaps people who are completely blind, should there be some limitation on their access to firearms, or should they have that right, which is, after all, in the Constitution, just like any sighted person?
They are United States citizens, just like anybody else. If there's no prohibitors, they are just as entitled, and in my opinion, more entitled to the right to self-defense as anybody. And what I mean by that is, you or I, when we go someplace, we jump in the car and go. Everywhere a visually impaired person goes, they have to walk. Well, you know, they don't have the luxury of being inside that locked container, the level of safety that brings.
Mm-hmm. Once your daughter turns 21, she's going to get a permit and carry a weapon.
That's another misconception about permits to carry altogether. You know, if she decides she wants to get a permit when she's 21, I want that to be her decision and not the government's. But really, people that have permits to carry, there's this preset notion that they get a permit to carry and they've got a gun on them 24/7 after that. And most people really don't carry them that often.
Mm-hmm.
There's some that do, but it's not what the public perceives.
Sheriff Wethington, this story has received so much attention this week around the country and around the world. What aspect are you most surprised about? Because I know you've talked about this a lot in the last week. What jumped out at you as something you didn't know?
Actually, it went from a story that I really didn't think would even ever wind up in the paper to, so far, I've talked to all the major networks here in the States. I've talked on Australian morning radio, talked to Canada yesterday. You Google my name, and, I mean, it's apparently worldwide.
Right.
But it's such a non-issue. This affects so few people, and unfortunately in this country we get our education from TV where people see gunfights in the streets, and you're not going to have that. These people with permits to carry are held to strict rules and laws, and it's not going to be any different for blind people. Mm-hmm. You know, they're capable of making decisions and rational decisions.
What has your daughter's reaction been to all this attention?
Well, I've kind of shielded her a little bit. She started college this year, and being visually impaired, you know, it's a stress trying to keep up with the paperwork and the schoolwork.
Sure.
In and of itself, and I just haven't allowed her to be pulled out. She, you know, she's kind of impressed that people are this interested in the issue. You know, again, she takes a little offense to the fact that some people think that since she's visually impaired, she's also not capable of making good common sense decisions.
Right. Well, Sheriff Warren Wethington of Cedar County, I want to thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We've been following the fact that this week Iowa's blind and their advocates have found themselves in the middle of an international buzz about a state law that allows visually impaired people to carry guns in public, to have gun permits. Joining us now, Steve Cusisto. He's a graduate of the University of Iowa's Writers' Workshop. He's also a Fulbright Scholar. He's now on the faculty at Syracuse University. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
Great. We miss you back here in Iowa.
Go Hawkeyes.
Careful, the Iowa-Iowa State game is coming up this weekend. We've got Cyclones
true,
listening,
but
too.
I have to reveal my loyalty.
Steve, you have been blind since birth. You are the author of a couple of really interesting memoirs, Eavesdropping, and also a very acclaimed memoir, Planet of the Blind, a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. We're calling you to get your reaction to the tremendous amount of attention this story has received, not only in Iowa, across the nation, across the world.
Well, first of all, I think that blindness is a low-incidence disability. There aren't many blind people in the United States as compared to, say, spinal cord injuries or people with, you know, post-traumatic stress disorders or even deafness. And so it's unlikely that the average citizen is going to meet somebody who's blind. And I start from that position because blindness then is kind of a mystery to people. And that's step one. Step two is that if blindness is a mystery to people, it's also the case that many, many folks don't think of blindness as simply a nuisance, as many blind people would say it is, but instead they think metaphorically about it. They think symbolically about it. And so they think that blindness is a great malady and a great deprivation. And this is almost an existential metaphor, that blind people are deeply helpless, profoundly impaired, not only in terms of their optic nerves, but they're also impaired in their judgment, right? The metaphors of blindness include blind rage. You know, it stands for a lack of knowledgeability. So people are really confused when they, you know, read the word blind, and they automatically tend to have assumptions about it that really literally aren't true.
So you can feel this as a person who's been blind since birth, and that you're the recipient of a lot of pity, and you don't feel that at all.
No, I mean, I side with the National Federation of the Blind, which is an advocacy organization that seeks to, you know, improve the quality of life for people who are blind. and visually impaired. And they argue essentially that blindness is, if a person has the right accommodations and the right assistance, is simply a nuisance, like anything else in life. But then the other thing that I think is important to say is that when people hear the word blind, they think of it as representing absolute blackness, like living inside a tree. And it comes as a surprise to the general public to know that 90% of the blind today in the United States have some vision. And this is because ophthalmology, which, as you know, the University of Iowa excels at, with its amazing, you know, Institute for Vision Research and the Carver Center for Macular Degeneration, its wonderful ophthalmology program, ophthalmology has gotten so much better. And so people who are visually impaired are often able to retain vision. It can be reduced vision, certainly, but it tends to be, in many cases, you know, reasonably good.
Mm-hmm. What about your vision, Steve? Do you have any partial vision?
I do, largely because I had an amazing operation at the University of Iowa that allowed me to get some vision back in both eyes. Now, is it good enough for me to drive a car? Absolutely not. I still use my guide dog every day in heavy traffic because, you know, I need that kind of help.
But what about shoot a gun? Have you ever done that?
Well, I have never shot a gun, but I would say that I have, you know, done plenty of adventurous things, including water skiing, downhill skiing, cross-country skiing, rock climbing, bicycling. Plenty of things are available to the blind and visually impaired. And that's the secondary thing that I want to say, that the other thing that people assume is that blind people have no friends, that blindness is a kind of existential loneliness that reduces them or, you know, hides them from the world, like the blind live in some asylum or something. Yeah.
There's a good little story that you tell in your memoir, Planet of the Blind, that illustrates exactly what you're just saying. I wonder if you'd mind telling us the story of your friend Dave on a venture to buy a TV.
Yeah, Dave was in fact a blind University of Iowa student and a friend of mine. And one day he went to a department store in Iowa City to buy a color television set. And there he was with his guide dog, and the salesman said, "Well, I've got this great little black and white TV set for you." And Dave said, But I don't want that set." And the salesman said, but the sound is just the same, and this is so much cheaper." And Dave said, "No, I want that big color set over there." And the salesman said, but why? You know, why? He couldn't understand it. Dave said, "Because blind people have families that like color."
they have friends.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, Dave wanted to have his buddies over to watch the World Series. So, you know, I think that that's an important thing to recognize, that blind people, you know, they go skiing or they go. I ran a marathon in Hawaii a few years ago. I ran it with my wife, who can see, and I had a little sign on my shirt that said blind runner. So I think it's important for the general public to understand that a blind person with what we call residual vision, or even a person who was totally blind but who was in the company of somebody sighted, might very well be able to get pleasure from shooting a gun, you know, going quail hunting. That's one thing. The other thing is that, you know, blindness as metaphor means in the public's mind, oh, this blind person, they don't have any judgment at all. They're just helpless. No capacity for critical thinking. That's what it stands for metaphorically. But it isn't true, right? A blind person carrying a gun, who can see things up close, is going to be no more or less dangerous than anybody else carrying a gun.
Right.
And then one other thing I might say, I mean,
sure.
as a writer, I spend a lot of time thinking about language and how it influences the way people think. We know, you and I and everyone else listening to the show, that guns in America are a very, very volatile issue. I mean, it's a very intense matter. And so there are a lot of folks who feel that guns in the hands of anyone are dangerous. And in the wake of all kinds of things like Columbine and Aurora and Newtown and all of that, that just the word guns excites a kind of dread in people. And then if you take an emotionally charged word like blind, people know almost nothing about, and put that next to guns, you're going to get an almost wholesale disregard for the facts.
Right.
And it's been interesting to me. I'm a kind of progressive type. I watch MSNBC and, you know, read the New York Times. And seeing even, you know, relatively smart outlets like the Rachel Maddow show posting on Facebook absolute hysteria about blind people and guns in Iowa. And all this, what this really tells me is how little people know about the blind, but also how much guns are just laden with a kind of anxiety, you know, as a sort of symbol to people, so that nobody's thinking critically about this at all.
I wonder if Steve, if you had a look at the Onion with its satirical look at this story.
I didn't. I should.
Okay. Well. Right? Okay. Let me do a couple. Let me share a little bit with you. I want to see if this is. If this is funny to you, here goes. So the Onion has a took a look at this by doing a mock person on the street interview article with three pictures, I think, and asked the question of these three people: are you okay with visually impaired people purchasing guns and carrying them in public? And here are a couple of the responses below the pictures, the mock responses. Okay, but they should promise to shoot only at super scary sounds. And another one response was, it's a tragedy that they'll never know how cool they look holding a gun.
I am amused. I think you can't live your life without a sense of humor.
All right.
You know, on the other hand, you know, as I say, an awful lot of visually impaired people, you know, would not go out with guns on their own. They would go out in the company of sighted companions to do this as sport. If a person who had 20/200 vision, which is considered legally blind, had a gun, I can guarantee you that they would see well enough to be able to defend themselves if that was something they needed to do. And I think that, you know, a certain degree of hysteria has to be unpacked from this. I don't know that, you know, you and I together today can accomplish that. But in general terms, I think it's the metaphorical quality of this, the symbolic quality that scares people. But the reality of it really, you know, isn't remotely as bad as it sounds. Remember that blind people aren't going to be going out there and spraying bullets wildly. This is the comic image that immediately comes to mind, because people assume that blind people don't know anything.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, dead wrong.
Right. Steve Cusisto, thank you for joining us with your insights on this unusual story we've had pop up in Iowa for the world's consumption this week. And do come back and say hello when you visit Iowa, all right?
All right. Thank you, sir.
Steve Cusisto, graduate of the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, and he's now at Syracuse University. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Coming up after a short break, we'll talk with former astronaut Clayton Anderson about life in space. He's accepted a position at Iowa State University, and we ask, what's behind superstitions on this Friday the 13th? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with this News Buzz edition of our program on this Friday the 13th. It's a News Buzz. We like to kind of flit from news source to news source, looking at some of the stories we didn't get to talk about during the week that we've been hearing about, not spending too much time on a topic before going on to the next. Coming up at the end of the hour, you'll want to stay tuned for this. What's behind that superstition of today, Friday the 13th? What's behind superstitions in general? We'll find out. And during the break, just to, I guess, to prove a point, my producers, Emily Woodbury and Ben Stanton, have placed a stepladder over me now. So I'm doing the entire second half of the show underneath a stepladder to, I guess, test this. Is this right, Ben? Yeah? Test it. We don't know. Hazardous pay for this part of the show? He says yes. Okay, here we go. We'll see how we do in the second half of the show and find out about superstitions at the very end of the program. Well, we heard this week an Iowa State University graduate is coming back to school to pass along some of his firsthand knowledge of space. Clayton Anderson, a former NASA astronaut, is joining the school's faculty. He'll be part of the engineering program in his role as a distinguished faculty fellow in aerospace engineering. Anderson spent 167 days in space, most of that time being served at the International Space Station. He joins us now live by phone. Clayton Anderson, congratulations on your new position and welcome back to Iowa.
Thank you. I'm glad you didn't make me come there for the interview. You know, since it's Friday the 13th, I'm afraid to go out of my house.
We probably would have found a stepladder to put you under as well, so that's a good thing there, too. What will you be focusing on in your new position?
The idea is that I'll be working with freshman students. Iowa State provides a freshman engineering course for aerospace that's comprised essentially of three parts, which is aircraft and space, and then a third piece that I kind of call engineering ethics, how to be a good engineer. I'll be responsible for the space part of it, which means I'll be coming up each semester to work with those kids. I'll also be doing some stuff for the university as they see fit, for the department in the university that seems to fit in with the roles and responsibilities that we've laid out.
Mm-hmm. What can an aerospace engineer who has lived and worked in space bring to the ISU program that an aerospace engineer who has always been earthbound couldn't?
Well, I'm going to give them all the answer sheets.
Okay.
No, you know, I hope that as I look back at my career at ISU and studying aerospace engineering, you know, it's interesting to hear the theory and see the equations and talk about all the theoretical aspects of what engineers can do. But I think the thing that I can bring to the table is the fact that I've actually been able to see and do and participate in a lot of those things. And it encompasses everything from robotic operations to virtual reality training to interacting with computers and experiments. I think all those things are valid in the future, especially with the onset of commercial spaceflight. You know, the odds of Iowa State students participating in commercial spaceflight in the future are much greater than they were when I was a student. So I'm excited about all that.
How long do you think that'll take?
Well, it's hard to know. You know, the current schedules have people lauding commercial human spaceflight with test flights in the 2017 range. But having been there, the other thing I can bring is realism. I think that in my 30-year career at NASA, I watched a lot of projects and programs that were scheduled to be, you know, live and working by X date be X plus several years date. So the idea that we put dates out there is important. It gives us something to shoot for, but I think invariably between budget constraints and problems that crop up that we need to solve, it takes longer to do than we anticipate. So it's hard to give you a date, I guess.
Clayton Anderson, you have taken two trips to the International Space Station, the first for, I believe, about 5 months. That was back in 2007, and then a shorter one, 15 days, a resupply mission, a total of 167 days you've lived and worked in space. What is the hardest thing to get used to in transitioning to life in a weightless space station?
I think there are a couple things. First of all, the separation from family and friends is not necessarily difficult, but it's something you have to overcome, and NASA does a great job providing us opportunities to speak, to email, to converse, to see video conferences with our friends and family. So there is a lot of work ongoing to make life on board the space station seem like life on Earth. Obviously, you can't go outside and mow the grass or smell the air or head to the movies, but you can certainly exercise and watch TV and movies and the news programs and communicate. You can do all that stuff, play computer games and those sort of things while you're in space. So the life aspect of it is pretty good in outer space. The other difficulty, I think, for me was the long training template. You know, to be able to go into outer space and live and work for 5 to 6 months requires a laborious 2.5-year training template. I'm not convinced that it needs to be that long, but the situation is such that it is that long.
Mm-hmm. When you get back on Earth, do you have trouble, as we've heard, perhaps walking around? You've got a certain amount of atrophy in your muscles?
Yes, I can only speak from my personal experience, but after my 5 month stay. When we landed, I felt great, but once they made me get up and move around, I didn't feel nearly as great anymore. There were several bags that I filled with intestinal fluid, so it took me probably a solid 24 hours to be able to walk and stand and sit and be normal, and I think that that would have been sped up had I gotten a good night's rest sooner and a good meal. So we had spent a long day on Discovery the last day when we came home, and that day was extended once we hit the ground on Earth, and I was exhausted by the time I finally got to go to bed, and I wasn't able to eat much that day because of my sick stomach and that sort of thing. So the following morning, waking up with a good night's sleep, having a solid meal, I felt 100% better and got better every hour.
Now, part of being at the space station is spacewalks. You've been on spacewalks there?
I've done a few.
Now we heard recently that they can be dangerous. Not too long ago, it was an Italian astronaut on a spacewalk who was out away from the space station, tethered to it, of course, but dependent on that spacesuit for oxygen. And he suddenly realized that his helmet was slowly filling up with water. What a horrifying vision that is. Do you know about that incident? How could that happen?
Sure. I don't think they know how it happened yet. The system, the spacesuit systems pump water throughout your liquid cooling garment, it's called, which takes the heat from your body and replaces it with the cool water temperatures. So it's a constant recirculation of this water and an exchange of temperature, hot for cold. So they imagine that it's coming from part of that system. They just simply don't know the mechanism with which it's getting into the suit. And it does a couple things. First of all, we've done hundreds of spacewalks and never had this problem before. Is it a problem we need to solve? Absolutely. But I think that we can be relatively confident that it was a problem within that suit, and we need to figure out what that problem is so that we can perhaps make a fix so that it never happens again. But in the interim, I think we can reasonably go out with reasonable confidence that it won't happen on a frequent basis. It's a very infrequent thing. And of course, if it does start to happen again, I think my understanding would be I would immediately cancel the spacewalk. But there's a team at NASA working on that and figuring it out. It would be scary if it was your helmet. I think they handled it very well. And it's one of those things that points out to the people that know that spaceflight is a very dangerous business. Sometimes the public tends to think, oh, there's just guys living in space, no big deal. Oh, they're launching a rocket, that's no big deal. It really is a big deal. It's dangerous. Every second matters. Every switch throw and every activity you do can have consequences that you may or may not be able to recover from. So one of the things I think our public has become desensitized to what it really is that the people in our space program do.
Well, Clayton Anderson, it's been great to talk with you, and we want to reach out and say that we can follow your activities at the website you put up there, astroclay.com. And,
right.
And actually, I stopped by your website, astroclay.com, earlier today, and we can see you in action. You can see you dancing in a very clever Gangnam-style music video parody.
Right.
Now, you want to say anything about that experience or what?
Well, yeah, actually I would. I think it's very well done. It was done by young students and co-ops and summer interns at the Johnson Space Center. They did it on their own time. They didn't do it on work time. I think it's an excellent parody, but it also tells you what JSC is doing these days in a very clever and a very insightful way that reaches out to the young people today. And I think that's important. Every taxpayer dollar that goes into our space program is a great investment, in my opinion, and we need to reach out to the young kids and the future taxpayers. When we had the Apollo program, we were going against those dreaded Soviets, so you had already had an incentive for Americans to want to support space, and we need to keep that going, and we need to get more kids interested in space, and if clever videos like the one these students did help, then I think we should continue doing it. And by the way, they're also doing parodies on the ESPN commercials. This is ESPN. They're doing This is NASA JSC, and they're very clever as well.
Okay. Thank you for talking with us, joining us, Clayton Anderson, astronaut, and now a new faculty member at Iowa State University. do check out his website and that video. Johnson style, I guess, is the refrain there. AstroClay.com. Clayton Anderson, thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you.
NASA Johnson style.
Just minutes away from finding out what's behind the superstition of Friday the 13th. I am under a ladder. You can hear it. This is the little crossbar thing. It's a little problematic. It's right in my field of vision. But I suppose I'll last of another 10 minutes till we find out more about those superstitions. This morning at 6:30, more than two dozen University of Iowa Army ROTC, ROTC members met outside of Kinnick Stadium in Iowa City to carry on a tradition that's in its 28th year. It's the annual running of the Cy-Hawk football from Iowa City to Ames ahead of the face-off between the rivals, the Hawkeyes and the Cyclones. That happens, of course, tomorrow. The University of Iowa's ROTC cadets, they carry the football, the same one that's made the trip for the past 27 years before Cy-Hawk games, to Tama. They meet up with Iowa State University cadets by mid-morning. Let's check how they're doing and talk to Lieutenant William Gensch of the University of Iowa ROTC. Are you there, Lieutenant?
Yes, sir, I am.
Thank you for joining us. Also joining us by phone, Cadet Andrew Kwan. Hi.
Hi, sir.
You are with the ROTC at Iowa State University. Thank you both for joining us. Lieutenant Gensch, tell me, how's it going? Is the football on schedule today?
Oh, it's going great. We arrived at Tama at about 11 o'clock and ran in to meet the Iowa State cadets and their program. We just finished the barbecue and the kind of compiling the food donations now, and we're just kind of generally chatting and enjoying the time together before the Iowa State cadets run the football for the rest of the way out to Ames.
Okay. So how does this work? Is somebody always running in a tag team fashion, always running the football?
No, sir. That'd be a little bit strenuous, and we'd have to leave Iowa City pretty early in the morning. What we do is we have a caravan of vehicles that transport the cadets from town to town. So when we got done with our mile-and-a-half run in Iowa City, we hit the road for Williamsburg, ran through Williamsburg, and then drove to Belle Plaine, ran in Belle Plaine, and then we went to Marengo and then finally Tama.
You talked about taking donations. What's your goal here? What are you raising awareness about?
We don't really have a goal. We've partnered with the Iowa Troop Pantry to support a unit on the border of Afghanistan in a very remote location. So we just try to collect items that they wouldn't normally have available. And this year we were trying to collect toothbrushes, baby wipes, Gold Bond powder, drink packets, and canned goods.
Okay, so you say the football's been handed off to the Cyclones now. They've got it to run it to Ames where the game is?
Yes, that's correct.
Do you know about when they'll arrive?
I don't, sir.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to it arriving. We will take for granted that it will arrive, even though, you know, it is Friday the 13th.
That's true. Well, we didn't drop the football. We didn't have any accidents on our end. So I hope the same. I hope the best for the Iowa State cadets as well.
Okay. Thank you for joining us, Lieutenant William Gensch and Cadet Andrew Kwan, and good luck with that football.
Thank you very much.
Okay, finishing up our News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer, and I'm still under this ladder that Ben Stanton and Emily Woodbury put over me for the last part of the show. Things are going okay so far. I'm still a little bit nervous, but we want to talk about Friday the 13th. Perhaps you have something you do on Friday the 13th to ward off bad luck. Perhaps those Cyclone and Hawkeye players will have lucky socks on. Who knows? It's not only Friday the 13th, but it also is falling on a year that is 2013, and we want to check in about this superstition and others with Sean Vucera. Sean Vucera is a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Iowa, joining us. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Ben.
We've got a few minutes here to talk about this superstition and others. What is the origin of Friday the 13th superstition?
Well, Friday the 13th is actually really layered in terms of where the negative associations come from. It has the number 13 that's perceived as, you know, having all sorts of negative things associated with it. You know, 13 people at a table is bad luck, in part because of the Last Supper. Fridays have been thought to be unlucky in sailing and maritime cultures. You would never start a voyage on a Friday. And so these seem to have been sort of pulled together and made Friday the 13th an especially bad day.
Funny you should mention the maritime. I had a friend who years ago took a trip to Antarctica sailing through some rough waters to get there off the tip of Tierra del Fuego on South America. He went onto the bridge and began to whistle. Now, I think it was a Russian crew gave him evil stares and immediately told him to stop. That's bad luck on the bridge of a ship to whistle, I guess.
Oh, bad luck to whistle. That's one that I didn't know of. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, why are our minds susceptible to the idea of superstitions?
Well, I'm a cognitive psychologist, which means I'm interested in the study of the mind and mental processes, including things like memory and perception. And, you know, when we look at something like a superstition, you know, Friday the 13th is pretty complex. But, you know, there are simpler cases where we can see superstitions that are maybe a little easier to understand. Now, in the real world, we have a wealth of experience where causes precede effects, especially with our own actions. We do something and there's an action that occurs, an event that occurs. So turning the key in the ignition is followed by the car starting, pushing the button for the elevator, and the elevator will usually eventually show up.
Mm-hmm.
So our memories are full of these instances where events are preceded by some cause. But the trick is that cause-effect relationship isn't always perfect, because sometimes events just happen randomly. Now, if those events that occur randomly are somehow memorable or if they're rewarded, then what ends up happening is that we tend to make the assumption that the earlier event somehow caused the later event, just based on our previous experience where causes really do precede effects. You can see this really nicely in cases where athletes have superstitions. So maybe one that your listeners know of is Michael Jordan, who wore his University of North Carolina shorts under his Chicago Bulls shorts for a large part of his career. So his UNC shorts were associated with his stellar college career, and the frequent pairing of his UNC shorts and the reward of winning could have easily led to a rewarded association between the two, where then the shorts were interpreted as having some causal role in the winning.
Mm-hmm. And what about good luck or bad luck? I mean, you've covered good luck, but okay, I'm under a ladder here conducting this little conversation. I suppose if I get up and something bad happens to me this afternoon, I'm going to remember it.
Yeah, exactly. That could also be more memorable, right? And you know, being under a ladder is a particularly nice one because, you know, walking under a ladder probably is bad luck. All sorts of bad things can happen. You know, you can have something dropped on you from above or you can knock the person off. And so, you know, the likelihood that something is going to happen if you were to walk under a ladder might be relatively high.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it does do that, you might be more likely to attribute that to the ladder rather than to, you know, your dumb decision to walk under the ladder instead of walking around it.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have just a minute or two left here. Is there a certain type of person, a personality type, Sean, who is more susceptible than others?
I don't study personality, but what little I know suggests that there are some factors that would play into sort of superstitious beliefs. The dominant view of personality is called the Big Five, which basically means that there are sort of five components or traits of personality that can be measured in everyone. One of those traits is called openness to experience, and that taps a person's intellectual curiosity and what we call their need for cognition, their need for thought to be sort of intellectually engaged. Individuals who have a high need for cognition tend to be very analytical thinkers, and that would suggest that they would be less likely to have these superstitious beliefs.
Right.
Individuals with maybe a lower need for cognition and who might be, you know, less analytical thinkers might be the ones who would be more likely to, you know, have, you know, bad feelings about black cats walking in front of them and so on.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you superstitious at all, Sean?
Yeah, I'm not, really. No?
You have never knocked on wood. Don't tell me you haven't knocked on wood.
You know, I probably have, but it's usually in jest.
Okay.
I wouldn't take that seriously.
Okay, very good. We'll leave it there. Sean Fusera is a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Iowa. So there's nothing special you're doing on this Friday the 13th or being extra careful?
No, not really. I'm just treating it like any other Friday.
Okay. I hope the day goes as well as it's going for us here. Thank you very much, Sean.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Sarah Bowden. Technical support from Dennis Reese, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows. Also on this Friday the 13th is Catherine Perkins. A little different theme music going out. See if you recognize it. You can see that picture of me under the ladder. A comment that I might look like Les Nessman at WKRP. See what you think. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend, and thanks for joining us.